You're listening to SurgeCast, a podcast made specifically for busy general surgery residents. Okay, welcome back to SurgeCast, everyone. We are still in the section of esophagus. This next topic is going to be esophageal perforation. And we're also going to go over how to repair those perforations because it can get a little bit confusing. So we'll do our best to outline it for you. I'll start with a couple reminders here about the anatomy of the esophagus. So the cricopharyngeous muscle is that narrowing in the upper esophagus, and it's actually the most common site of esophageal perforation overall. And that's usually iatrogenic. We'll get into that here in a second. But remember again that the esophagus also lacks a serosal layer, and that's the reason that it is a little bit more susceptible to perforation than other places along the GI tract. And one thing to keep in mind whenever you're thinking about these types of things is that the perforation in the esophagus is very, very serious. You know, it carries a high mortality, up to 10 to 40% depending on the circumstances, and a lot of that is also due to the time frame in which those patients present in. In terms of the etiology, so iatrogenic injuries are kind of the most common cause of all esophageal perforation, so that's usually someone doing an upper endoscopy or dilating somebody. But if that is the case, then the most common spot and the most common place overall is going to be that cricopharyngeous muscle. It can happen really anywhere in the esophagus, but if you get asked on your ab site, you want to say the cricopharyngeous. The one time that's not true is if the patient has a perforation after having a bunch of emesis, and someone who's having Boerhaave syndrome, for instance. And in that case, the perforation is most likely to be on the left lateral wall of the esophagus, just above the gastroesophageal junction, maybe 3 to 5 centimeters above it. Some folks who are involved in major trauma may have esophageal injury due to kind of blunt trauma to the chest. And the classic person that happens to is someone who has had a steering wheel injury. And then some other things to consider are folks who have or are taking kind of medications like NSAIDs, tetracyclines, quinidine, KCL, that are just pharmacologic agents that are caustic and can cause esophageal erosions. And then also some people have tumor-associated esophageal perforation, and finally foreign body ingestion.
So your big question is picking these up on a test. And so you really want to think about how these patients are going to present either to the ER after something like, you know, a vomiting episode, or, you know, in post-op after an iatrogenic occurrence. So generally, you want to think about these patients come in, they have epigastric or chest pain, they have neck or throat pain sometimes, and they can also present with dysphagia. So your physical exam, sometimes these patients will have crepitus either on their face, their neck, or their chest, which can be really indicative of esophageal perforation. But occasionally these patients really present without serious symptoms, and a lot of that is going to depend on exactly where the perforation is and whether or not it's contained or uncontained. And that's something we'll explain more as we get into kind of the operative treatment of this. The other thing you really want to look for is if you're thinking that this is a longer time period between the perforation and the diagnosis, you really want to have a high index of suspicion that these patients could be getting quite sick from mediastinitis or kind of other sepsis. And so having a low index of suspicion for that and really thinking about that when you're looking at these patients. As far as diagnosis, labs, and imaging, first thing to start with for a lot of these patients is an X-ray, both a PA and a lateral. That can show you pleural effusion, pneumomediastinum, or subcutaneous emphysema. Any of those things are going to really point you in the direction of esophageal injury, even if they're not going to help you determine exactly where the leak is. CT can also be used. That might help you demonstrate some air or fluid around the esophagus, but a gastrograph and swallow study is going to be the most important thing to really help you ID exactly what level the leak is. Remembering that you want to use gastrographin because the likelihood of a leak is very high for these patients. You don't want to be dumping barium into somebody's mediastinum. That being said, if you go ahead and do your gastrographin swallow and it's positive, at that point you're really considering whether or not you want to go to operative or non-operative treatment for these patients. If your gastrographin swallow study is negative for a leak or kind of equivocal, but you still have a high index of suspicion, at that point you might consider moving to a barium swallow. Again, being kind of thoughtful that that can cause problems if there actually is a leak present, but barium is going to give you a little bit of a better idea than the gastrographin. And then finally, Endoscopy can also be used if there's need to define kind of the location, the length, or the number of perforations, or if you really need to evaluate for another disease of the esophagus, like tumor or erosion of the esophagus, things like that. But again, moving right to endoscopy is really not indicated because of the risk of worsening the perforation. And then moving on, so you've figured out this person does have kind of a perforation, kind of what's your next step? So let's talk about who can be managed non-operatively and what you can use to help decide that. So when you're thinking about these, the first decision you really have to make is this a contained leak or an uncontained leak? And that's something that you're going to be able to pick up on imaging is it localized to one area, it's not spreading throughout the mediastinum or something like that. Patients who are contained kind of in the neck or in the mediastinum without extravasation, they have no associated pneumothorax or pneumoperitoneum, and then they also have to be clinically stable with no indication of sepsis. That's the subgroup of patients who can be considered for non-operative treatment. And so non-operative treatment for these patients consists of making them NPO, they need IV fluids, and they need IV antibiotics with broad spectrum coverage, remembering that the esophagus is kind of not a sterile structure and it's opening into some sterile areas like the mediastinum. They also need antifungal coverage. Patients with larger perforations who are gonna have more prolonged recovery need to be evaluated for TPN. And then you can also consider kind of depending on the location of the perforation, remembering, you know, you can't really stent in the cervical esophagus, but lower perforations, kind of thoracic or abdominal esophagus, stenting can be considered, especially for patients that are really poor surgical candidates who are presenting with esophageal perforation.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I'll kind of go into now the operative management. So this can get a little bit confusing, especially on a test scenario. And so I'll try to break it down for you in a way that's more palatable. When you're looking at a patient who has an esophageal perforation, you're thinking that they probably need to go to the operating room. You take these following kind of three things into mind. So number one is, where is the location of that perforation? Is it in the cervical esophagus, the upper two-thirds, lower one-third, et cetera? Number two is the time frame. Has it been less than 24 hours since they've started having symptoms, or more than 24 hours? And finally, the presence of associated disease, such as a malignancy or a motility disorder, et cetera. So the next thing you want to think about once you've figured all that out is, what are your operative options? And so generally speaking, they're going to fall into one of these kind of three or four categories, which is, you know, wide drainage, some sort of primary repair, a diversion and exclusion, or an actual resection of the esophagus. And so with all that in mind, we'll just kind of go through the different things you should kind of be keeping in mind to help you get the right answer on an exam. So first, in terms of location, if the perforation is in the cervical esophagus, you're going to use a left-sided neck incision. If it's in the upper two-thirds, then a right thoracotomy is a little bit better approach because it avoids the aorta and the heart. But if it's in the lower one-third, then you can use a left thoracotomy. And if there's any intra-abdominal component to it, then you can also use a laparotomy. So again, that location is going to drive the approach, the operative approach. Second thing is to think about whether or not this is, you know, a contained or uncontained perforation and the time frame. So if it's a contained perforation, as we said, the patient's stable, they're, you know, not septic, and there's no anatomical contraindication, like, you know, it's not at the cricopharyngeus or something like that, then it may be amenable to stenting. But if it's a non-contained perforation, then you get into some of the more nuanced operative decision making. So if it's a non-contained perforation, it's been less than 24 hours and with minimal contamination, then, and it's cervical, then you can do wide drainage alone. Otherwise, you can try and do a primary repair in two layers. And so that's going to be an inner absorbable suture and an outer permanent suture. And of course, you're going to leave drains there. So one thing to consider, especially as you're on your way in making that thoracotomy, is what are you going to end up buttressing that repair with? And so a lot of folks prefer to use intercostal muscle, but some people also use pericardium, pleura, omentum, whatever they can kind of get their hands on. And so once you have actually exposed the esophagus, the most important and kind of crucial part of this is to extend your myotomy so that you're exposing the full extent of your mucosal injury. And then, and only then, once you've figured out exactly how big that mucosal injury is, can you start removing that devitalized tissue. And kind of the principle there is that, you know, that inner layer of the mucosa is, sometimes the injury can be quite long, but you might not see it, unless you extend your myotomy outside of it longer than that, if that makes any sense. And then finally, again, you're gonna place wide drains, and then you really want to kind of give consideration to a placement of a distal feeding tube like a J tube. For the patient who has a non-contained perforation that's presenting now after 24 hours, or if there's extensive contamination, then you can consider resection like an esophagectomy. But more than likely, what you're going to end up doing is some sort of exclusion or a diversion, like a cervical esophagostomy. And what that essentially is you're, kind of suturing the perforation closed and then kind of diverting proximally. So if it's in the mediastinum and there's a lot of contamination, then what you can do is just plan for mediastinal washout and make a decision at that point. And again, always consider the need for a distal feeding tube. One last thing is that if there's any associated kind of pathology like a malignancy, then you may want to consider actually doing a resection like an esophagectomy at that point and taking it from there.
So what do you do after an operation for these people? Remembering that these people, anybody who really gets an operation on their esophagus is going to need to be NPO for several days afterwards. You're looking at usually about 5 to 7 days. Because of the total length of that, oftentimes when you're in the operating room with one of those patients, you do want to go ahead and place either a gastrostomy or a duodenostomy to provide them some enteral nutrition during that time. If the patients are clinically stable, they can begin some oral intake as soon as they have a gastrographin study post-op that shows no leak. They're going to need broad-spectrum antibiotics for at least 7 to 10 days after the operation. And the drains should remain in place until they have that gastrographin study definitively saying no leak. Complications that you want to be aware of. First of all, there's obviously a risk of stricturing kind of post-op. That can usually be managed with endoscopic dilation. The other issue that can come up is a leak. Lots of them can be controlled just with drains. You just want to keep those people NPO, keep the drain in, repeat swallow studies kind of at different intervals in order to determine when that leak self-seals. If it's uncontrolled, those patients probably need to go back to the operating room for urgent reoperation, either for drainage. They also, depending on the size of the leak and kind of the complications from that, might need diversion and resection.
Awesome. Okay. So we covered quite a bit. Why don't we get into the high points now? So number one, what is the most common cause of esophageal perforation and where is it most likely to occur?
So the most common overall cause is EGD, and that's responsible for about 50% of all perforations. And the location that most commonly occurs is at the cricopharyngeous muscle.
Okay. What are the first kind of tests that you would do to assist in the diagnosis of an esophageal perforation?
So likely your very first choice is going to be an X-ray, kind of the PA lateral. That may show you pleural effusion, pneumomediastinum, or sub-Q emphysema. But your real definitive quick test is going to be a gastrograph and swallow study, and that's the gold standard here.
Okay. What kind of patients are you, in which kind of patients would you consider non-operative management?
So patients have to be clinically stable, no indication of sepsis, the leak must be contained, and they must have no associated pneumothorax or pneumoperitoneum.
Okay. And when you're thinking about taking someone to the operating room, how do you figure out what your operative approach is going to be?
So really depends on the exact location of the perforation. So perforations in the cervical esophagus should be approached through a left-sided neck incision. Patients in the upper thoracic region need a right thoracotomy to avoid the aorta in that section. Lower thoracic, left thoracotomy, and for very distal perforations, then you can consider a laparotomy.
Okay. And finally, how does the management of a non-contained perforation kind of differ if they're presenting at less than 24 hours or greater than 24 hours?
So at less than 24 hours, often those patients can be managed with myotomy in order to evaluate the injury, followed by removal of the devitalized tissue, primary repair in 2 liters, with drains placed, and then a tissue flap for coverage. Patients that are at more than 24 hours are those that have really extensive contamination, need a bigger operation. And usually they're gonna require resection or exclusion and diversion. Those patients should also have a mediastinal washout at that time for the extensive contamination. And then at the same time, placement of a G-tube or a J-tube for decompression, drainage, and feeding access.
Okay, excellent. That's going to wrap this one up. We will see you for the next one. Thanks again for listening to SurgeCast.
You can find SurgeCast on Spotify or iTunes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram or Twitter @SurgeCastPodcast or find us at SurgeCastPodcast.com.